Hi, this is Aaron from Gangland Wire. You're going to want to join me and Gary Jenkins for the 2018 Mob Summit in Las Vegas. That's right, folks. Las Vegas, baby. We're going to be there June 15th, 16th, and 17th. Three crime-filled days with author Frank Culotta. Gary Jenkins is going to be there as well, speaking about his app, talking about his movie, sharing his book, Leaving Vegas. And then Larry Henry of the Mafia Chronicles is going to be there as well, and many, many more. We're spending Friday evening mixing with the mob at the Plaza Hotel. Saturday from 9 to 1, we're in panel discussions about the mob. Saturday night, we're going to be rubbing elbows at the Mob Museum. And it continues Sunday from 9 to 1 p.m. at the Plaza Hotel in Las Vegas, baby. It's the 2018 Mob Summit.
This is Larry Henry, author of the Mafia Chronicles, and you're listening to Gangland Wire.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, good evening, all you wiretappers out there. Welcome to the Classic Old Ice House in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, tonight, this is part of our ongoing series, The Media and the Mob. And tonight we have an old friend of mine, a Kansas City Star reporter named Bill Norton. Bill and I go way back. I first met Bill. Say hello, Bill.
Hi, everybody.
It's great for you to be here tonight, and I'm just starting to tell folks just how far back we go. And here's my first memory. The mob reporters have to have contacts with the police department, with the prosecutors, and sometimes within the criminal elements themselves, as you have maybe already heard. I'm not sure where this will come in the series. I know Ned Day out in Las Vegas certainly had some at least peripheral kind of criminals who was feeding him information, and Bill may have too, but he also liked to have cops on his payroll, so shall we say. Now, I wasn't really on his payroll, but first time I met him, they had a picture. He was a cub reporter, shall we say, not really cub, but he was a young reporter, and at that point in time, the Kansas City Star, our local newspaper, and I believe you worked for the Star at the start, didn't you, or was it the Times?
I worked at the Star.
Yeah, the Star was the evening paper, and the Times was the morning paper. But the Star was kind of the flagship, shall we say, the more read paper in the evening. And they assigned one reporter to work the police department, the police beat, and they had an office on the third floor of police headquarters. They just gave them a little desk and a telephone, I think was all that was in there. And at that point in time, probably an ashtray, more than likely. Right, Bill?
Right. And a manual typewriter.
And a manual typewriter. There you go. And so he could phone in his stories. He could type up his stories. He could do it all right there. And being physically inside police headquarters, he could develop sources. The Star printed a picture of a guy. All of a sudden it hit me. His name was Jack Anderson. He had a strip club over in Kansas City, Kansas, the Red Apple, and Carl Sparrow and some of our other local mob guys hung out there. He got in a conflict with Corky Savella, and Corky had paid a guy named Gene Shepard to bomb his car, just not to kill him, but just to scare him. He was really wanting, I think Corky was wanting to move in on the Red Apple is what the deal was, but the Star printed a picture of him in the paper, and I can't even remember why. So I dropped by his office. I said, "Hey, Bill, I'd like to get a really good copy of that picture," and that started our relationship. I think that if I could help him, lots of times he thought I knew more than I did, or sometimes I couldn't reveal what I knew to him, or wouldn't, whatever. But we helped each other over the the years and developed into a long-lasting relationship, which we still know each other and talk once in a while and see each other at certain places in our retirements. So, Bill, what do you remember about getting started in this mob reporting business?
Well, I was a police reporter from 74 to 78. And so when the River Key blew up and the murders were going on around the city, I was covering those as part of my routine and covering the cops. And then I can't remember, there was the hearings, I can't remember the date, but with Senate hearings in Washington when Freddie Bonadonna came in and testified behind that screen so nobody could see him and testified about how bad things were in Kansas City. Not long after that, the chief of police then, Norman Karen, contacted the Star and wanted to meet with the editorial board. And so when he was talking about the mob something. And so there were quite a few reporters and other people in the boardroom, as well as the whole Star editorial board. And Chief Karen at that time said there really wasn't a big problem with organized crime in Kansas City. And several of us looked around at each other and kind of shook our heads. And I'd known Chief Karen, so wasn't sure where he was going with that. But he left, and some people talked to one of the managing editors and said, you know, this is just not so. I mean, we don't want you guys who are new to Kansas City, the editor and the publisher, to believe that we don't have a problem. And these guys had come from Louisville, and there was no mob that they reported about or knew about. And so one of the guys, the bosses, looked at me and he said, okay, I want you. And then he reached out to Dick Johnson, who was another reporter at the time, and said, I want you to start finding out, you know, what is, you know, up with organized crime. And initially, I started out doing a history. So we had new editors then came in not too long after that. And one of the editors looked at me and he said, what are you doing on this thing? And I told him, and he says, I don't do history. So you got about 3 months to turn this around to a contemporary, you know, what's the status of mob in Kansas City? So that's when we really had to scramble. And I don't remember ever working so hard in my life, but it was, and that's how I started getting involved. I had made contacts over the years in different agencies and the PD and other places. And I just started, and I read the history. The Star had the most amazing archive of tracking the mob in Kansas City and the Pendergast era and all that stuff and all the corruption in this town. I mean, it was amazing to me because I'm not from here.
Where are you from?
I'm from Peoria, Illinois, where I was raised. And I knew about Chicago, for example. I didn't know a lot, but I knew that but I had no idea how wide open a town Kansas City was, because it didn't seem like it was terribly wide open when I got here. It seemed kind of tame. But
how did you end up here?
My wife, we were 2 weeks from getting our wedding date, and my wife was looking for a job, and I was working in Moline, Illinois, and she was coming out of college at MU, and the Kansas City Times hired her. And she took the job without calling me and letting me know. But, so I had about 10 days to tell my bosses that I had 10 days left on my deal in Moline. I didn't want to stay there, that's for sure. But that's so.
Yeah, if you were covering the crime beat in Moline, it wouldn't seem nearly as exciting as Kansas City.
Well, you know, what's funny is they wouldn't trust me to cover crime in Moline. I thought I was too new, too green. And the Star, on the other hand, I had never really written a major story except for some school board coverage and stuff like that. Never written a real crime story before I got to Kansas City. And the weird story is, I don't know if you remember Sterling Ford.
I do.
Okay. Well, somehow, before my time at the Star anyway, I got there in 73, Sterling had retired from the PD as the major detectives. And he took this job as the police reporter for the Star. And so he was at headquarters. And the Star created this deal. They wanted to swap copy editors and reporters. And so they'd look for – somehow mine was going to be a two-week swap. Copy editor would go in and be a reporter for 2 weeks. The the reporter would come in and try to be a copy editor for 2 weeks. I have no idea whose idea that was. But I went down to cover for Sterling, and he showed me the ropes for about 3 days. And then Monday, when I was due back there to work with him some more, he never showed up. And so I was called to consider on temporary assignment down there until they could find somebody. And 4 years later, they still hadn't found anybody.
Where did Sterling go? No one really is sure.
He just retired.
He just retired again.
He just walked away.
Yeah, he just walked away.
He'd had enough. And, you know, because I would think that, you know, that would be the loneliest office in the police department. You're the reporter, and nobody wants to talk to you.
Unless they wanted something.
Yeah, because, you know, they're going to get in trouble from their superiors. You know, they're not supposed to be talking to the press.
Well,
you know, they may compromise a case unless they have something specific to say.
We were chronically accused of compromising cases, which, to my knowledge, never happened, at least in my situation. But at that time, the Star and the Times were covering the police department like at least 20 to 22 hours out of the 24 hours in a day. So I had the morning shift from like 6:30 until 3:30 or 4, and then another guy came in about 1, and he started reporting for the Times, and then someone else came in, I don't know, about 8, and then he stayed until who knows how early in the morning. But trust me, the press room was used by the cops a lot.
For a variety of different reasons.
We had a couch in the press room when it was on the second floor, and that was before Gary and I met, and I was advised not to sleep on it.
You know, so, really?
Yeah.
I heard the stories. I was too young.
Yes, I was too young. Yeah, I missed all that. Well, I don't know.
Could Sterling Ford have been there too often?
No, it wasn't Sterling.
No, it wasn't Sterling.
Nighttime detectives.
Dog watch. You know?
And this is what I'd be kind of wondering would be, here you come in, you're not from Kansas City, you're basically kind of by default assigned to cover the police beat, and who was your predecessor that, when you go back and you're researching all of these old stories, who was kind of the... You know, the guy that would be like, if you could go talk to anybody that was a Star reporter.
Oh, I would go talk to Harry Jones. Harry was still on the staff then. And, but I think he was kind of, maybe he was winding down, maybe not. But the Star had sold in like 77 or 78 and brought in new owners and people like Harry, who had been at the Star forever. I mean, 30, 34 years, 35 years, something like that, had acquired a lot of stock. In the company, it's a privately held company. And when these guys, when the buyout came, or what do you call it, when the sale came, some of these guys were instant millionaires.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. And because that was, the Star didn't have a retirement plan.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the only retirement plan was if you could afford over time to buy stock. And I won't go into all that story. But yeah, so Harry, down not too long after that, decided to leave the paper and, go do other stuff. And J.J. Maloney had been around and covered a lot of mob stuff.
Now that's quite a story. Since he's not around, tell a little bit about J.J. Maloney, and I'll kind of get you all started. J.J. Maloney, when he was a young man, shot and killed a guy in an armed robbery in St. Louis and was doing life in penitentiary. The Star, he started writing letters to the Star, I believe, didn't he, Bill?
And also poems.
And poems. Oh, I didn't remember that. So go ahead and tell a little bit about J.J.
Well,
background. And
there was a guy named Thorpe Men who was our book editor at the time. And I think J.J. had communicated a lot with him in terms of his poetry. And Thorpe really liked it. And so I don't know how it got started exactly, because I wasn't here then. But the Star, you know, I went to the parole board or someone and pitched this idea that they would take care of J.J. They would kind of sponsor him. So Thorpe Men and Harry Jones more or less kind of took him under his wing. And he was unlike any reporter I'd ever met. He had more swagger, more snark. I can't imagine what happened to him in prison. He was like a kid when he got...
Yeah,
he got sent to. So he knew from prison some of the guys who were out on the streets here in Kansas City. So he had an inside, you know, he knew people we would never know.
Oh, no, no doubt about it. He could walk, and he liked to drink a little bit.
Oh, he did.
And he could walk into those joints where those mob guys and those professional criminals hung out and know somebody in there, mm-hmm. know them well. And
yeah.
He could, I can imagine the inside information. He probably didn't report some of the stuff that he got, a lot of the stuff he got. He may not have put it in because it would have put them at risk and him. And
right.
you know, we've never really lost a reporter other than Don Bowles down right. in Arizona that I know of, but that we might have lost OJJ.
Yeah.
He kind of, you know, he was too close to that life in a way.
He was. I mean, he got in some deals, you know, with liquor control and some other stuff. Because there was nobody that JJ wouldn't look under their skirt.
Yeah.
Mostly, though, it was related to mob stuff, the bars, you know, and in liquor control, wherever liquor was sold, you know, Star was always looking around on those liquor licenses and who owned them, because there was so much shadow ownership in town. And
yeah,
but JJ could go eventually kind of find out about that.
Oh yeah, and then our good old liquor control agent Nelson Martin, I believe, was his
yeah.
name, and we won't go into this at depth any more than what was reported in public records at the time. But he was running a business on the side who sold cleanup services to
yeah.
bars while he was being a liquor control agent.
Right.
Now I think that's probably enough said about him.
Right.
But JJ probably, he's the one that dug that up, I believe.
Yeah. Oh yeah, and there was another guy, and I can't remember his name right now. That JJ, he was more of a street agent for them at the time, and he and JJ met and then for some reason didn't like each other. But JJ was, I think he was fearless.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it's kind of like, you know, you can't do anything to me now that hasn't already been done to me.
Interesting.
So that was kind of his attitude. Yeah, I'd been drinking with JJ.
JJ, yeah.
He's right, so a bottomless hole.
You came up from a college education, though, right?
Right.
And here's JJ coming up from the streets.
Right.
And you're both kind of like beat reporters, if you will, for the Star at different times.
He didn't do a beat as in, like, when our beat system originally mostly was, we had beats that were like city hall, county courts, police department, a couple others, where we sent reporters into these operations and had them have a press room or something so that they could report from there. Usually they were just public institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had other people. And so that was a very specific beat. Although, you know, if you're covering City Hall, you're covering 20-some floors of and how many departments and one thing and another. So it's a huge undertaking. Police beat was smaller, but it was still a pretty big undertaking once we really figured out that how integral the city government was with the police department and otherwise. That's another story. But
really?
But then people in the newsroom, like JJ or like some of the other people, would have kind of a generalized beat, say like something like social services. So, you know, that person would be involved in trying to cover the news that came out of every social service agency in greater Kansas City, or, you know, the schools. I don't think we had a Kansas City School District has been in the news since I got here,
yeah.
or since before I got here. But I don't think they ever had a place at headquarters. I might be wrong. But we had two reporters assigned to the Kansas City School District. So we had people who were stationed in institutions, public institution buildings with offices there. And then we had other people back in the newsroom. JJ's beat was sort of crime and evil. I mean, he wrote about other stuff, but for the most part, you know, he worked with Harry a lot in the beginning to really, you know, get a foothold and to really kind of look into the outfit and some other places or other. But he was more of a bit of a maverick.
Yeah.
Know? He was really hard to control. But I don't mean that in a bad way. But I mean, as a manager trying to manage an employee,
right? He probably wanted to dig up his own stories and run with them in his
right.
own way,
right.
rather than taking an assignment. Say, hey, go find out about this.
Right. And he was dogged.
Well, but I would still think it wouldn't be necessarily easy to get information. A lot these guys didn't want to be in the press. And I mean, there were some highlights that you talk about historically, like the killing of the two Charlies. But that was the 50s, early 50s.
Right, yeah.
And then you don't hear a whole lot. To me, it doesn't seem up until, into the 70s, you know, kind of Gary's era, when then there was that fight for the parking at the River Quay and then the subsequent revelations of the skimming. And so, but there was a lot of mob activity still going on. Much of it's still Vegas that they were completely unaware of. And then so the guys like JJ, how do you go about just digging up a story when your editor's like going, get me a good hard-hitting story on prostitution?
Never Star would never do that. Okay, do it quite well, that
they're
way.
Not but, that, they're not that salacious.
Yeah,
not,
yeah
not,
right.
Not then.
Well, you know, that's a job of a reporter. I mean, somebody will see a problem or think there's a problem, somebody in the news operation, and they'll say, go explore this. Mm-hmm. Find out about this. And so then your job is to go out and begin. You know, you, first of all, in my case, I'd read all the background I could, and I'd make a list of all the names of all the people I could find, get their phone numbers, you know, put them in whatever parts of the of my file I would need, because there would be some people would know this about, you know, somebody might know more about liquor control over here, and somebody might know about urban city parking over here. And so you try to establish contacts everywhere. Now, they're not really sources. I mean, if you think about Woodward and Bernstein and stuff like that, mm-hmm. but they were touch points. They were people you'd learn over time who would not lie to you. Or they'd tell you they couldn't tell you something. And that's the way, I mean, that's how Dick Johnson and I got started when we were assigned to do the mob series, was because I didn't have that many sources outside the PD. So I had to really scramble. And so I talked to a couple people and Joe Henderson used to cover the federal courthouse and
Bill Owsley, you wouldn't get a chance. He was on the scene at that point, wasn't he?
He was, very much so.
But not necessarily somebody that was approachable?
No. Bill would not have been approachable.
No. And there were.
He seems so friendly now.
He is. He is when he's in here, but he would not have been approachable at that point in time.
I made my bones with Bill one time, and it was after I think he'd just retired. I did a retirement story on him. And he had known me, so he had known my work. I mean, that was always the thing with those guys. You were always tested by them, by your work. They all knew you. They all knew who we were. They all knew what kind of – they all had an attitude about us. At least that's what I found.
You got the sense they'd read your stories?
Or they'd gotten your reputation from somebody else. You just hope that they got the reputation from somebody who gave them the straight skinny and not – you know, there are people you make mad, and they won't talk to you, or they'll dog you to somebody else. So you just have to work through that by showing people that you're consistent, you know, in how you treat the subject and how you treat the people in the subject. But yeah, it's not easy. I mean, when I went to the police department, for example, I didn't know anybody. I mean, I knew Sterling Ford. I had met the people on the second floor in the homicide unit because we were basically doing crimes against people. But then I had to go and learn who the police chief was and the whole entire hierarchy of the police department. I had to learn, you know, to separate investigations from patrol. You know, then you got to visit, you know, if you want to know the patrolman, you need to go out and visit them in their environment. You can't do everything from police headquarters. Unfortunately, some of my nights got a little distracted in the effort to find out something. I would end up at a bar with somebody, and I couldn't remember what I wrote.
Well,
so
you got to apply a little grease, a little oil to the wheels to make them turn a little more smoothly.
Right. So,
loosen lips up.
But then you could get.
You didn't have a tape recorder?
No.
That's always what you see in the movies. They're like, set the tape recorder down, and that's just not real.
And here's the deal.
It wasn't real for us.
They don't work many times. They won't work very well. They just sound like, what was that? What did you say? And you don't want to get caught doing that.
Yeah. Sounds like those guys were drinking.
Yeah. If you get caught with one of them, nobody will ever trust you again, and they'll tell everybody. So, it's best not.
It's best by, like, he maybe take some short notes and recollections on a bar napkin.
Well, that's like Woodward and Bernstein. Yeah, you've probably done stuff like that. But most of the time I was with guys, sometimes I was just going to make connections and to be entertained or whatever. My kind of rule of thumb was, you know, if we were talking, I would try to remember as much as I could. But if I needed to take a note on something they said, I never wanted to use information from somebody and when they knew I wasn't acting as a reporter, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
But you'd go out and act just like you're another guy, not another cop, because they hated that. Boy.
Yeah.
But you're just like you're another guy meeting a bar and they know a little bit about or something like that. But they always knew I was a reporter. But if I needed something, I always carried a notebook and a pen or a pencil or something like that. And if I needed to really take something down that I'd heard, I would ask. I'd say, hey, you guys mind if I do such and such? I mean, I've done the, you know, go to the bathroom in the middle of a conversation and try to write down everything I could remember. But that wasn't standard for me because I had the one thing I had to do, like, was I had to face these guys every day.
Kansas City's a small town, too. You can't run. No. You can't hide.
Yeah, you can't.
Same thing on the case of the guys that you're trying to cover. I mean, not just the because you're covering the police, but in covering the criminals and certainly the career criminals, you know, when we talk about the known Kansas City mob, Nick Civella, his brother Cork, Tuffy DeLuna. I mean, this was their, this is the wheelhouse of their era before they really came down.
Oh, absolutely.
In a way, they like owned the city, owned kind of the underworld, the bar scene. And in many ways, they kind of did in the early 70s on up to the middle 70s. So, Bill, and I know they read you.
Yes.
And you know they read you, don't you?
Yes.
which did it ever make you nervous that you knew these guys were reading you and paying attention to your stories?
As a reporter, I was generally kind of nervous anyway. I had to really overcome, you know, not a struggle, but I wanted the story more than I wanted to pay attention to being nervous. And as I'm not a real assertive person by nature, and you had to be assertive with some of these people, and that was sometimes awkward for me, but I, you know, went ahead and did it. Yeah,
In an era where bodies would show up at the airport in the trunk of a car.
Yeah, or in the trunk of a car over in the projects.
It wasn't because some guy committed suicide and waited 8 or 9 months to be found.
No. But it was funny because, you know, I would always tell my wife that, well, the story is that they'd never hit the newspaper because we'd just unload them. Like, you never hit a cop because that's such and such. And she didn't buy it. You know,
she's George Anna didn't
buy it. I don't care what that is, you know. But when we did a series on organized crime to establish there was, in fact, an organized crime problem in Kansas City.
Was that big series you did after the wiretaps and the
after the wiretaps and before some of the stuff got loose?
Yeah, for some reason, they let you come into our unit, in the intelligence unit, and sit down and read the files. That was unheard of before. For some reason, somebody bent over backwards to help you guys. I never got the whole story behind that.
They really wanted to make the mob look bad.
that's what it was, I'd say. Right. But upper management got into that.
Sure. I mean, there was a source that came to me. I had no idea why. And he was probably one of the most knowledgeable people about what was going on at that time in Kansas City. And I you know, I think I even called this guy editor at one time because he would, you made connections. And but you asked me about being nervous. In that series, the first day we had an overhead video picture shot of the neighborhood up in Kansas City North, and we published that in the paper, a big, you know, full half page of the paper or something like that.
And this is where all these guys live, their personal homes, where their children, wives, and children live too. They all lived in the same block, practically.
Yeah. I mean, like an aerial view of where their houses are, pointing out where their houses were.
Right. And we then identified who lived in what house.
Nick Civella here, Corky Civella here, Tony Wright's house was here,
right.
Pete Tamborello was down the street.
Down the street, et cetera.
Maybe Gary could just put that into his app, because when he put the actual address in and people went up and knocked on the door, he felt concerned enough that he took the address out.
I did. This guy got hold of him, and he said, and I put the intersection in up there and said, this is where Nick Civella used to live when he was alive. So this guy goes up and he gets out, and there's still one of the houses is still occupied by some Civella descendants. This guy gets out with his camera and starts walking around taking pictures, and somebody comes out and says, hey, what are you doing? And so he tries to tell him. That guy, oh man, it became a standoff of some kind. Whoa. I never figured out exactly how far it went. They didn't actually, you know, start swinging at him or anything, but the guy got back in his car and left. Then he gets hold of me and tells me that story. It's like, oh man. So I just, I took it out. You still kind of in general on the app, but I took the rest of it out. It's now, I don't want anybody going up to their house and walking up to their house.
Well,
never entered my mind that anybody would do that.
Before we started the recording session, I know we're pretty close to 30 here. If you want to just keep going in the session.
Just keep going,
I was going to say there was a comment that you Gary had made about taking a photo of one of the guys at KCI.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Tell us that story, Bill. Okay,
we're just kind of trying to pair this together a little bit from the pre-conversation before we start recording into here you are, you know, showing aerial photos of where these guys live. I could understand why they might be upset. You see some of the videos that day, or maybe it's just local stuff from Mob on the Run where, you know, Cork is just like, I'm just a guy. They're following me around. They just, because they got a job and they got to make their pay. And so they're following me here and they're following me there. I'm just a guy.
Yeah, well, that was, I remember that one too.
Oh, boy.
But go ahead and finish that off about what happened after you republished that photo. I remember that. They were mad.
Oh, yeah. First thing that happened was I lived about four blocks directly north of that neighborhood. So my wife thought we were really vulnerable.
I can imagine that.
The second thing was, I drove through the neighborhood on the way to somewhere. Maybe I just did it deliberately to see what was going on. And there were literally people doing their Sunday driving with the map and the picture out in front of, like, the wife had the picture and the husband was driving or something like that. And they would point at these houses. And I just thought, oh, man. And we got a call from Nick or one of his representatives. I didn't. Someone at the Star did and said, I want to talk to you all. And, you know, that's the one thing I missed. I was doing an assignment somewhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And he
came down to unload on us and swear up and down. Yeah, as he did. He said, there's no mob in Kansas City, and I'm certainly not its leader. I'm just a poor, humble, you know, Italian guy with, you know, used to have a job making bread. I don't know what he said.
Fruit peddler, probably.
Yeah. But
kind of wrangle my brother in. He's crazy.
Right. Oh, and then the worst thing, then we had, I don't know, four more days of it, which was, you know. But we are looking at the
Teamsters.
That was
the first of 4 days of reporting.
Right. Yeah. Right. It was a huge series on the mob in Kansas City at depth.
Oh. Yeah. Remind me to, after Straw Man, right before Straw Man broke, there's a funny story I could tell you about that in the press. So.
They know who you are.
Yes.
And at one point in time, when you first learned about Nick Civelli and him being the mob boss, your editor sent you up to the airport because he heard Nick Civelli was coming in.
Well, I had been covering Nick long distance because he was in the medical center at Springfield, the Federal Medical Center. So when we found out the date that he was coming home, he had been sick and, you know, had cancer or one thing and another. So they were sending him home because he was too sick to be in prison. So we knew and we found out where the plane was going to land. And Chris Canella, who was a braver person than I am, who was our photographer, were standing there looking down the tunnel sort of between the airport and the plane. And here's Pete Tamborello and I can't remember who was on his other side and all these people holding him. And maybe he was frail, but he really looked frail and all that stuff and this entourage of people. It's obviously they didn't really want to talk to us, but Chris kept shooting pictures. And I think sometimes maybe it's easier to be a shooter than it is to be a reporter because you have to, you know, intercept these guys or try to talk with them. But they made it known, at least to me, that they didn't really want to make any communication. They were a little bit irked. But we made, I don't know what page of the paper that was on the next day. But
that photo?
Yeah, the photo was. You know, and that they didn't like their pictures in the paper. They didn't like their names in the paper. I mean, it was just, and other people in the community who were, Italian-American community in particular, were upset any time that we portrayed the mob in any way, any shape or form. Because they wanted to not be associated with it whatsoever. But that was, I was kind of nervous watching Nick and these guys who were a lot bigger than I am, escorting him up the ramp. And then I think he, at that time, he had a white Cadillac with a blue
Landau roof.
Blue Landau roof. And that was there waiting for them. And they got in that. And I think, if I remember correctly, and then they took off and then they alternated their speed all the way down to 29.
Followed them all the way back to the city.
Well, I followed them quite a way. They would slow down to like 50.
Yeah.
And they'd stay at 50 for a little bit. And then boom, you know, they'd jump up to 70 or 75, whatever it was. And then they'd slow down again. And, you know. And,
maybe you weren't the only one following them.
Well, that's what they were looking for.
I hope they had, well,
You were hoping the police were surveilling them. Yeah. I don't think we were.
No. Once I found out how they worked straw man, I said, you know, guys, they're using planes. You know,
yeah, so right.
You're not going to get very far. But
Maybe a spotter car that backs off as soon as they let the plane know where they are, then you just back off and wait till the plane tells where they sat down.
Yeah.
But, you know, and during straw man, which is the skim trial, you know, in Kansas City, the local FBI here is the one that started the skim investigation out in Las Vegas by a little hidden microphone at the Villa Capri and caught Tuffy DeLuna and Carl Savella talking about the Teamsters and millions of dollars and Genius and Lefty and then spun off to several other wiretaps and when that all came to fruition or came to a head and they started the trials, the Star had been covering this. At the end, they covered it a lot. Once they released the night they took off Tuffy and or took off Carl Caruso, the singer, they called him the singer with $80,000 in his coat pockets. And Bill tells this story. He said, we always wondered where they kept the money. And he said, you know, I told him, I said, well, empty your pockets when they intercepted the courier coming in from Las Vegas. And he said he figured it'd be in the briefcase in some kind of a hidden compartment or in his shoe or something. And he pulled $40,000 out of one pocket and $40,000 out of the other inside coat pocket and threw it on the table. So, you know, huge headlines. When that case came down, huge headlines. And then there was a trial. And they covered that. You know, that was a national, there was national coverage on that trial because they brought Joy Iupa and Jackie Cerrone and Joey Lombardo from Chicago down here and Milton Rockman from Cleveland and Frank Ballesteri from Milwaukee all into Kansas City. So the reporters, Kansas City Star among Washington Post, everybody, Chicago Trib and The Sun and Sun Times and all of them were in Washington, I mean New York Times, and everybody was covering this story.
Now the case got so big that you didn't feel afraid anymore?
No.
Well, here, there's a good story associated with this.
Or you moved from more than four blocks living from where they're at.
He moved. No, I didn't move until 84.
He went in the witness to protection program to Johnson County, Kansas.
Yeah, right, Johnson County. Pastor Castle. So,
yeah, he got him a McMansion out there in Johnson County.
No.
South of Whitehaven.
Yeah.
So anyhow, there's a story connected to your coverage of the mafia and that story, that series that you guys did in particular and other stories you were done. Yeah, tell us about that. That's a pretty interesting little story.
Well, as the trials were approaching, I got subpoenaed. And the idea by Nick and company and the lawyers and they wanted to find out where I'd gotten all this information. I think there was maybe another reporter from the Times who also got subpoenaed, but they picked me first. I don't know
lucky
why.
Lucky you.
Yeah. So I'm sitting on the stand, and the defense lawyers are grilling me about what, you know, where did I get this information? Who was this person mentioned in your story, et cetera, et cetera? And I basically said, you know, that I wasn't going to identify anybody. And so sometime during this procedure, this back and forth with the lawyers and me, Nick Savella talks to somebody, and he suddenly goes around to the jury box, which is pretty close to – he'd been sitting with his lawyers. He goes around to the jury box and comes all the way down to the end, closest to the witness box. And I don't know, it's 15 – feet, 15,
or less. It's probably less.
Probably less.
And, yeah, it's real close.
Right. And he sits there in his little, I think he had a white, you know, shirt on or something, and he started saying, hey, Bill, take it like a man. Take it like a man, Bill. And the deal was his lawyers said, since I wouldn't testify, they wanted me jailed until I would testify or would, you know, identify my sources or whatever. And so it's getting close to noon hour, and I'm already a puddle of Jello up on the stand. And the judge said, "Well, I think we're going to wait until after lunch, and then we'll discuss this again with Mr. Norton whether he wants to claim his First Amendment rights or something." And so, you know, it's just I don't even know. I ate that. I can't remember if I even,
what kind of lunch did you have?
I don't. It wasn't memorable.
You didn't know if you were going to come back and be taken away in handcuffs?
I had no idea.
Dressed in an orange jumpsuit?
I had no idea. But, And we come back in the courtroom an hour or so later, and I think Nick was in his place again, and finally the judge said, "Well, gentlemen, I do not think I'm going to make Mr. Norton answer those questions today." And I was like, "Oh, praise, you know, whoever you are, thank you.
Jesus. Yeah. Thank you, Lord."
Do you get some immunity from court and laws based on being a member of the press, for one?
Well, it's not really immunity. I mean, it's...
Did you not want to say, "Well, you know, they just brought me into the intelligence unit and opened up all these files, and I spent like 3 days just looking through all these files. If you knew what they did that they're not charging them on, you'd be amazed." Hey, Nick, why don't you take it like a man?
Yeah. Well, anyway, we won't go there. Yeah,
you didn't. Had they shown you those files at that point?
Yeah.
But you didn't want to tell people that, is what you're saying?
No, absolutely. I didn't. With anybody who was a.
Would that affect the case, I guess?
Yes.
Because bad publicity?
Right.
It's unfair to a criminal to get bad publicity. I mean, that was Martin McNally's argument that got him sprung out of jail early, right? You don't know Martin McNally. He's an airline hijacker we interviewed. And he was supposed to get out in like 2086 or something like that. And he got out in 2010. And part of that was that he as a jailhouse attorney for himself, argued that excessive publicity affected the sentencing.
He did that when they tried to do the escape with the lady
with Brock Trapnell.
With Brock Trapnell, and he was going to be tried for attempted escape, and there was so much publicity because this Brock Trapnell was and this helicopter pilot killed the lady that tried to hijack him to land at Merriam, that he argued that there was so much bad publicity that he couldn't get a fair trial, and they ended up dropping it for that reason. You're right on that one. But in this case...
Well, there are two things in this case. I mean, one is publicity, but that's really, to me, kind of a smokescreen. The real deal is to try to find out if anybody who was an investigator on this, one like Strawman or Argent down the road, had disclosed something to me that was illegal. And so that way they would discredit it by arguing that the...
because they showed you the evidence, they couldn't use the evidence.
No. They used whatever... The idea was that they're not supposed to talk to anybody outside the Bureau or the police department or, any of the law enforcement agencies and tell anybody anything about what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because it becomes a matter of publicity, and then you... It's not that you've blown anything, but they can then be prosecuted because it's against the law in some circumstances for people to disclose anything.
Plus, it's common.
Which doesn't make sense because there you are in an office on the third floor of the police department.
That wasn't illegal. What we did was not illegal because we just gave Bill general information.
Yeah.
Now, if the FBI or U.S. attorney had called him in, they were looking for that more than anything, not really looking for the PD. They were looking to see if the FBI or the U.S. attorney had been leaking them information, trying to, in an effort to kind of spoil the jury pool or to make it look like that they were breaking the law in order to make their clients look bad, and then they could start attacking the U.S. attorney because the case was good. So when the case is good, when the facts are against you, you start blowing smoke into the wind, and it was really a smoke blowing thing, trying to obfuscate the relationships and try to dirty up the prosecutors and maybe say, well, they break the law here. It wasn't really the police department in particular they were looking for. They were looking more for the U.S. attorneys to do that because it was definitely a no-no and a violation of federal law for them to do anything like that.
But they weren't doing that.
But no, I don't think they were. They may a little bit on the side, but Bill's just he's like giving this little shitting grin, so he's not talking about that.
Yeah.
And they did a little bit more, no doubt, in my mind.
You didn't,
I don't have direct knowledge of it.
You didn't have an office on the third floor of the federal building or anything like that there was any kind of...
they did.
Well, who knew?
But I wasn't,
what are the odds?
I wasn't on that in that office, but... I had worked there a couple times, substituting for another guy.
I mean, this isn't just a right place at the right time moment in your life. They knew who you were, and this was a national case to some degree. They're kind of trying to figure out if there were there's maybe some other leaks going on.
Yeah,
in the
too.
Case.
Yeah, mm-hmm.
And so they bring, and rather than bring in the guy from the Times or the Post, you're like, you're the local guy that they know.
He had obviously.
It was you or JJ, and JJ was gone, right? Right.
Well, he wasn't active in that story for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, he wasn't. He was more active on a street level. He didn't really get into the what we call the upper echelon of organized crime. He dealt with the more street level and guys in the bars and that kind of thing. And he had great sources into that, though.
He did. He really did.
But
a lot of that stuff he couldn't. It was great information, fun to listen to, so hard to use in the paper.
Yeah.
Because you couldn't corroborate it.
Yeah, so supposition, you know, and stories and that kind
stuff
of
like
thing.
That. So,
well, anything else that you remember, Bill, about covering the mob in Kansas City, or we wind this down?
Yeah, I don't want to get into all the details, but just suffice it to say that one day I discovered thousands of pages of documents, and there was a release date on it. And so I relayed to my bosses that I had made this discovery, and I said, this is the most important discovery we've made in covering our mob in Kansas City. And we rented a hotel room, not just a sleeping room, but a conference room or something and put up a bunch of tables and got a couple of typewriters, three electric typewriters. Harry Jones was one of the other writers, and Joe Henderson was one of the others, unveiled all these documents. And I can remember Harry in particular looking down and reading, and he's going, it's all true. It's all true. I was so, I mean, for Harry, I think that was a great moment. I mean, it's a great moment for me, but I wasn't the one who had spent decades, you know, trying to cultivate sources and get to know stuff. And the U.S. Attorney's Office had been locked down heavily. I don't know what happened. It's just a coincidence, I guess, of different people colliding at the same moment around a particular mob event. And, you know, as far as the paper was concerned, we were really fortunate to be able to get some access. But it was so much fun to see Harry looking down at these things and going, it's all true. He'd spent a lifetime in talking to people and inferences and one thing or another, but this was no Kansas City Crime Commission report.
Yeah.
This was the real deal.
The real deal.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. That was fun.
FBI 302s or
not talking about anything.
It just corroborated that you know, there was Nick Civella was the head of the mafia, and he was connected to the larger picture.
Is there a statute of limitations on any of this?
Yes. I don't know.
Sounds like Gary may have seen these files himself.
I don't know if he did
at some point.
But it was a really good moment for the paper, and it was a byproduct of a lot of hard work. These things just don't happen overnight. So it was a good moment.
Somebody called you and said we just were cleaning out some drawers and we left a box out back, and we figured we'd let you know.
Well, let's pretend we had a parking garage deep throat moment. So
Mark Felt was in town.
Yeah, Mark Felt was in town.
Because I know Uncle Frank, Frank Sigarusa, would say, you know, and has said this to me personally before, he's the nephew of Tuffy DeLuna, mm-hmm. would say, you know, you never hear a good story about all the positive things that the mob did.
Yeah, I've heard that one before.
I mean, now you got 1,000 pages of all the bad stuff. Did you ever have a good story?
No, because that wasn't whether they did something good. Didn't have the
that didn't get a 304 form.
A 302, whatever. I don't know, but I'm confident there are 302s. That's what the bureau calls them.
Yeah,
you probably
right.
got reports too of Nick and the guys at the St. Joseph's table up at.
Over northeast, over
in Pius up there by Pius and stuff like that.
We did. I don't really remember, but yeah, the St. Joseph's table over there at Don Bosco. You know,
right.
They give money and uh-huh. that kind of thing to that.
Yeah, they were.
So, yeah, I'm sure they
big
did.
Contributors.
Big contributors.
No, not huge, but
I mean, they wouldn't pull out $40,000 out of one breast coat pocket.
It wasn't no five figure. Don't
and
know.
Then $40,000 out of another breast coat pocket.
No, but they were. You know, they were. This was a low key, reasonably affluent group of guys.
Yeah, exactly.
And they were not flamboyant. I don't think anybody was. Everything was kind of Kansas City, you know, low key, and not on the down low, but certainly. But yeah, and they were respected, some of them in the community, for things that they had done in the community, like the St. Joseph's Table, or I'm sure that they did a number of things that were totally legitimate. But no one was bringing them to our attention. And I'm not sure how they would have felt if we'd showed up at Pius, for example, and you know, decided we wanted to cover the St. Joseph's dinner, and because Nick and Cork and all those guys were doling out money to this church, I mean, that might have been really unforgivable.
Yeah. They probably didn't want coverage no matter what.
No. You're right there, Aaron. They didn't want coverage whether they'd done something good or bad.
Right.
So
right.
It'd be hard to write a good story because it's easy to cover that up. Police aren't out documenting the good things that they do. If
right.
They see them do something good, you're just like, oh, okay. Yeah.
Well, good stories don't sell papers, right?
But bleeds it leads.
Yeah.
Right. It's TV.
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, I'm sorry, Bill.
No, that's okay. They've merged now. I don't know.
Yeah, really. So. Well, interesting. Oh, you know, one more thing.
Yeah.
We're getting pretty close to the end. We need to get this. One more thing. You asked me about the real story about the night that the Sparrows got killed and the surveillance on them.
Right.
He's always accused me and some of my fellows.
I have never accused
of knowing something. There was a murder, a big shooting in a joint one night. Bill was up at his house. I know this from talking to him before. He's up at his house having a drink or two in the evening, and three masked men who were, we find out subsequently that it was Tuffy DeLuna and Joe Ragusa, and who just died recently. Do you know that?
Yep.
He just died, a month or two ago or 6 months ago. And Charlie Mortina burst into the back door of this club called the Virginian. The three Spiro brothers, Carl, Mike, and Joe, were all sitting in there. Carl was actually up at the payphone, I believe, in the front of it. They come in, and two of the men spin to go to the table where Joe and Mike are sitting and just start shooting at them. And Tuffy DeLuna with the shotgun sees Carl up by the front door, and Carl sees him, and he runs out the front door across the street. Well, about 10 minutes or probably less than 10 minutes, 5 minutes before that, a couple of our intelligence guys drove by there and saw Carl Sparrow up on the phone and got about to Independence and Prospect, which is about 15 blocks or so from Independence or Admiral, Virginia. And they hear the call come out, shooting at the Virginia Tavern, and they go flying back over there. And there's Carl Sparrow laying, you know, shot up in the middle of Admiral Boulevard.
Admiral Boulevard.
But the story got around after that we had been following the Sparrows, and which we had off and on because we knew the Savella faction wanted to kill him. And we had followed him. Matter of fact, that's a place where a few months later he's in there when he comes back, and we catch Joe and Tuffy and I think Charlie Mortina stalking him. And matter of fact, I pulled up right next to him and I look over. I'm looking straight ahead, and we're trying to move in close to see who it is. We know it's somebody. And I get around on Paseo, and I pull up next to him at 12th and Paseo.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel these eyes on me, and I look over, kind of glance over, and there's Tuffy just staring at me with this kind of shit-eating grin on his face. And they spun off left and just kept on going. We didn't have time to get a uniformed car over there to get them stopped because I know they had guns. I know they knew Carl was there. We found out later that Joe had spotted him and called Corky on the phone, and Corky said, do you see any agents around there? And he said, no, there's nobody around there. Well, we were sitting way up the street.
Mm-hmm.
And Corky says, hey, he said, if you don't see them, that means they're there. He said, don't do anything. But he disregarded that order, and he got Tuffy and Charlie Mortina and went back, and we're driving around, you know, checking things out when we had to move in closer. We couldn't just let him walk in and kill him. So we knew that something was going on, and when we moved in closer, we got burnt. So that's the closest I came to that. But there's a newspaper report came out right after that, that we were following Carl Spiro, and but we pulled off just before they came in and hit him, kind of indicating that, you know, well, why did they pull off?
You let it happen. So how did that car get 15 blocks away before it turned around to go back?
Well, it just did. I mean, they weren't following him that night. Their assignment was not to just follow him. Their assignment was just to kind of cruise the north end and see what was going on and who was where and who was drinking where. And so they weren't supposed to just sit on him that night. There's a difference.
Because the story I wrote after that was not, I was...
You get down to the Virginia Tavern then?
Oh,
yeah, he gets a call from his editor.
Yeah, that they've got had the shooting.
And apparently, he wasn't too far off. He couldn't drive down. Luckily,
no. Yeah, I was there in probably 15 minutes.
You could have driven over to Nick's house and seen him pull in.
The killers pull in. What was the scene like when you pulled up there?
It was Carl had just been taken away, and it was just, you know, it was not mayhem because there were, you know, law enforcement all around. You know, there's, and you know, I saw people that I knew but couldn't talk to.
Yeah, your sources.
Yeah. So so I just kind of wandered around a little bit. I mean, there was this. I think the blood was still in the street.
Oh yeah.
But what I did, we had interrupt. JJ was down there, and I can't remember how.
He'd probably been drinking in there earlier.
Yeah, could have been.
I know he drank in there.
Yeah. And then I think there was somebody else there was somebody from the morning paper who was
going
to try to write something as well. But so the story I did was just basically about using a case file and trying to document, you know, what was going to go on now for the next day or so. And I think JJ took the crime, quote unquote crime, and who did what story.
You were going to document the investigation,
yeah.
And as they send detectives out and start interviewing people and doing area canvases and knocking on doors and trying to talk to the employees
and as much
that
as
kind of thing. Nobody had talked to them.
Yeah, they didn't have any. No witnesses came forward. Oddly enough.
Well, what about the lawyer?
Funny because there's a gal that worked at Chubby's on Broadway who I worked there part time. Hired me years ago, and Peggy Land, and she goes, "Oh yeah, I was in the Virginia Tavern that day. I left about 10 minutes before." She might know who some of these people are.
Well, they were masked when they came.
I'm not saying that she made any phone calls. She left the Virginia Tavern.
Right there's a question, Bill. Who do you think set him up down there? Somebody had to set him down. Yeah, somebody had to make a call and say he's down here. All three of them are down here because that was not that usual for all three of them to be in one place at one time. Somebody may have dropped a dime on them.
I don't know who was the bar owner.
Frankie Todaro owned the place.
Okay,
I don't think it was him. Lawyer of he was talking. Carl was talking to his lawyer, so his lawyer knew he was going to be down there.
But who was the bar owner that was blown up on top of his in his parking lot?
Oh, that was Gary T. Parker was blown up out in front of Tony Mike Bonadonna's joint over at not too far away. Was he? Would they?
You know, there were some. As I met a guy within a year or two after that, who shared a prison arrangement with
Parker T.
No, with Tony Ripe and those guys.
In federal penitentiary.
And he introduced me to the idea that they had a lot of people who would do things for them.
Oh yeah.
And they were just a lot of street hangers sources. Stuff like that. So, you know,
Could have been anybody.
Could have been anybody
in that bar. Could have been in there and walked out and ran right to the closest payphone. Now he was on the phone with a guy named John Caricio, who was a jewel thief, who was part of a jewelry theft crew, who had done some business with a guy named Vince Abbott, who was Tuffy's main guy. Yeah. I think Vince Abbott's still around. He's the last man standing, actually, out of all that crew.
Wow.
I believe last I heard after Joe Ragusa died. But so I don't know. Could have been Caricio could have called down there and got him on the phone, kept him on the phone. But somebody else probably dropped the dime. You're right.
Yeah, I don't know who it would have been though. I mean, I could only speculate. But like I said, you know, you'd think about X number of people because you know the names. But there were so many other people who were doing things for them, tipping them off to stuff that may not even be in your files.
Yeah, it probably it's not. I don't think it was ever. I've met with these guys. We meet periodically. Still, a lot of us, Housley and Wisher, and a lot of them for lunch about every 3 or 4 months. And And we still talk about that one every once in a while, and you know, still nobody knows for sure.
Yeah. Well, at the time, I don't know, like now, if there's a shooting, they kind of try to lock the place down, and they don't just let people leave. And I don't know, maybe at the time.
They would have that night.
They would have done the same. People would have been like, there's a shooting. I'm getting out of here.
Most of them do. But whoever was there, they locked them down and got their names and talked to them at least a little bit.
Yeah.
I don't think there was a mass exodus like you see in some of those.
No, probably not.
It was probably somebody who had left beforehand.
Because they were there. I mean, you guys were there really fast. As I recall.
Well, yeah, Errol Nichols right down the street. Right. He turned around and came back.
Right. So, you know, there was...
he beat all the district guards there. Right. He was the first one there.
So there just weren't a lot of... you know, I don't know how many people actually made it out of there, but I don't think there was a... I never heard anything about being a large crowd that suddenly diminished.
Probably not many, because Nick didn't say anything about seeing that. And he was he had his partner there, and they were the kind of guys that even though they were paying attention to Carl, they would not have been so wrapped up in that they didn't notice what was going on back over at the bar.
Yeah.
They went ahead and called it in. Of course, they'd already gotten the call, but asked for an ambulance. And asked Carl who did it, and he said, I ain't tell you. Yeah. I'm not talking. He was a man. He was a stand-up dude. Did you interview Carl?
Yeah, I tried to because there was one of those times that they thought he was going to be killed.
Yeah. You know,
they picked up something, I guess, somewhere, and I got onto it, and so I called him and talked to him a little bit, and he just, man, I'm not going to, you know, he's up there in Holt or somewhere.
Yeah,
and
he lived out in the country.
And he wasn't going to do anything different. You know,
he was a man.
He manned up on that.
Yes, he did. He was such a man that he couldn't. He continued his criminal career out of his wheelchair.
Uh-huh.
And finally, folks, the end of the story here. Carl Spiro walked into his little used car lot.
Wheeled in his
little used car lot shack, and the shack blew up and blew him in the wheelchair halfway out of the lot.
Oh man, that wheelchair was just.
They were sitting up the street waiting for him to walk in, and then hit a plunger and blew up.
Yeah. And now that was like TV.
Yeah, it was. It was. That was
like television.
Television kind of a
deal. They might have been watching TV and got the idea.
Yeah, really. Probably.
That wasn't like the other story that we did when we first started doing the podcast, and they're using like the garage door opener, and it won't.
That was a Spiro story, only that was a Joe Spiro trying to blow up Tuffy DeLuna, got the bomb underneath his car, and he's like plunging on the sending unit, and it won't go off.
Oh.
Tuffy just drives off from the Villa Capri. So Joe makes Conrad Metz, who is there with him, a younger guy, makes him go up and get the bomb in the sack and bring it back. That's a hell of a story there.
Oh, Joe. What a...
He ends up blowing himself up with his own bomb down at the storage lockers. So, anyhow, this has been great.
Years later. I mean, this was the heyday of the mafia in terms of they're blowing things up, they're killing each other. You know, all the Vegas skim is coming out, the Argent file case, and I mean, so you could write a book yourself.
I offered to write it once, and I think an agent turned me down. So, but you know, there was so much more to know. I mean, there was just so much that I didn't know that came out later. That you know, it was an interesting time. It really was. I try to tell people now, anytime you see that movie Casino, remember that it started here.
It started here.
Oh, that doesn't matter. You know, so anyway.
But
it was an amazing time to be a reporter. It was so active.
And, you guys even formed, you know, we had this other interview about IRE.
IRE.
IRE, yeah. Investigative Reporter of... what's the E stand for?
Investigative Reporters and Editors.
Okay, Investigative Reporters and Editors, IRE. Just say IRE.
Right.
And how that started. If I remember right, the Star finally, after a little bit, started a small unit somewhat like that just to do like political corruption stories and those kinds of things. Then they just kind of a dedicated little squad.
You know, I don't remember.
You may have been transferred out of...
Yeah, I may have been gone by then.
You moved out to another beat away from some of that. I believe they did. We ran into one of their reporters and a photographer one time. We were on a surveillance, and they picked up the same information we had. There's some politicians and some mob guys meeting at Nichols Lunch at 39th and the Trafficway on kind of a regular breakfast on Sunday morning. So we were down there to see who it was.
Yeah.
So one of the guys drives up around an alley off of 39th Street, and he said, hey, he said, there's somebody up here behind this billboard with a camera and long lens taking pictures. Yeah, is that one of us? He's not one of our guys. Yeah. It turned out it was a star.
Yeah, I guess it was in the van.
Working on that. Were you there on that?
I got the tip.
I didn't know you. I thought you were going.
And you knew it was a good tip because then the intelligence unit guys that you knew were pulling up to get, like they normally go there and get coffee and breakfast.
No, we knew about it. And a fascinating list of people.
Yeah,
and,
big money people, politicians,
business owners, and one guy had a big business over in KCK.
Yeah, and then one kind of mob guy had a wrecking building demolition company who did a lot of city business and city contracts.
And then the city council people.
City council, but
we heard about that, and so we rented a van and. And got it all set up, and we put together a small group of people, and we showed up. I don't know how many Sunday mornings we were there, but it was more than once. And we sent a girl inside, and to this day, no one in their right mind would ever think she was a reporter.
Yeah.
I mean, great kid, you know, nothing like that, but you know, she could fool you. So it was. She went inside and tried to get as close as she could and hear what was going on.
Actually, Rachel Whipple and I went inside too one morning at breakfast to kind of get a little closer look, see what's going on.
Yeah. It was pretty. That was stunning. If there had been something that came out of that, that would have really been amazing.
You know, it's one of those stories that you can put them all together.
Right.
Then you need something to happen.
Right.
That then. Indicates what was going on, and nothing ever happened to indicate what was going on.
You needed somebody inside.
Or somebody inside, and nobody ever got that.
Well, a lot of these mobbed up guys had legitimate businesses.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So, I mean, they still had some legitimate business interests.
Oh, sure. But it was surprising to see the city council people and some of these guys.
And the banker.
And the banker, you know, going in there. It was that was unusual. I mean, I had never seen that before. I'm sure it happened back in River Key days of some fashion.
Yeah, but not quite like that.
Not quite like that.
Yeah, that's for sure.
And to be regular about it. It should have been an Italian joint, man.
It should have been. It probably happened over in Independence.
Oh, okay.
Eastern Jackson County politics.
Yeah, probably a lot. So.
All right. Well, this has been great, Bill.
Thank you.
We really appreciate you coming in, and this will be part of our ongoing series. I'm not sure exactly what you won't be the first in the series, and you won't be the last. No. I don't know. I want to start with the IRE investigation, and hopefully I can get in touch with Harry Jones, who was part of founding that. And I appreciate it. Aaron, you got any other questions you want to ask Bill? Anything you want to say? I see.
Well, I'm just looking at my notes here, and you after you left the Star, you were 74 to 78 covering for the police department. How long did you continue to work for the Star?
Oh, in 2008, I retired in 2008.
In 2008,
yeah.
Wow.
I didn't do the same thing all the time.
Yeah,
but yeah.
But you were there from 73 to 2008.
Right.
You even had the. Not children's page.
Teen Star.
Teen Star. He was editor of the Teen Star.
Isn't that funny? Go from the mob.
I know. I used to think that. I'd see your stuff in there, and I'd think, well, how interesting.
Well,
you know, has Nick Civella read the Teen Star recently?
Right. I would have preferred to have been in the newsroom, but I had to work for a particular editor, and they would not let me change. And so an opportunity came up the original idea was – they created this teen thing to try to encourage after the riots, the Rodney King riots in L.A.
Oh, yeah.
They
yeah.
decided to, you know, Mayor Cleaver had come out and said, please, business in town, help us employ kids. And so the Star, you know, hired like 8 young people. And I didn't involve that summer, but the thing revived itself or was revived in 94. They were looking for volunteers. And I would have done anything to get away from this particular editor. And so I just volunteered to do it for the summer at the most. And I wanted to do it because I wanted to learn more about inner city kids, inner city life, you know, what was going on. I wanted, you know, you can talk to the adults, but it's hard sometimes to really get to know the kids and that kind of thing if you're not out in the neighborhoods all the time. So this would have been a great opportunity, but then it turned into a full-time job, which I ended up staying there for 14 years.
But, I know.
But, you know, the politics in the newsroom had changed. The things I wanted to do probably weren't as, you know, desirable. And I'm sure, like, you know, in the PD, sometimes there's an A list, and every editor has an A list, and yeah. they have a B list, and they never admit that.
So you didn't feel like you missed out on a great story, like with the Bob Burdell murders?
Oh, I was done. I got roped in a little. I didn't. I mean, Tom Jackman made a book out of that.
Yeah. He was kind of the guy on that.
Was he the guy that followed you then in your shoes reporting?
He went down there for the Times. I think the guy who followed me was Greg Reeves.
Greg Reeves.
And then
yeah.
Steve Kraske.
Yeah, Kraske. Oh, yeah. Right. Kraske started down there, didn't he? Yeah. I remember that. I was down on the third floor myself, and he was right around the corner. I gave him a tip on a really good story on an embezzlement over the school board.
Yeah, good. But he, that was, I went out and did a, I wanted to try to make some more money. So in 80, I went out and tried to sign, I took a job as a bureau chief. So it's kind of the lowest editor in the newsroom, but you're supposed to get paid better as an editor. But when I was still out there, though, I had some of the people that I had known while I was covering organized crime and the PD remembered me. So I got a couple of great stories while I was working out there. It had nothing to do with Johnson County, but it had everything to do with... Well, remember when the judge was killed down in Texas, the federal judge?
Oh, yeah.
Woody Harrelson's dad?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
They were working through an inmate up here at Leavenworth.
And, as an informant on that? That's a story we ought to do, Aaron, one of these days. That's a heck of a story. Maximum John is who they called that judge. He was going to give this Jimmy Chagra dope dealer out of El Paso a huge amount of time, and Woody Harrelson's dad killed the judge.
So,
that is a hell of a story. So I didn't know you reported on that.
Well, I just reported on the local connection because of all the stuff that went on in the prison and how they had to do stuff inside there was pretty interesting.
Did you ever find yourself in a position where somebody... I would say, you know, confessed to a crime that maybe they hadn't confessed to before, where...
Well,
I mean, for whatever it's worth, people want their name in the paper, or, you know, like I'm trying to think of the one where there was an episode where they, you know, he came forward and told people what was going on and they found more bodies. Who was that episode we talked about? Gary's looking at me like with a blank stare.
I lost it. But, I don't know.
But there was.
But did you have any stories similar to that?
Well, this is probably a little bit different than what you're thinking about, but when. Nick Civella was in, when Tony Ripe, his nephew, was in prison, I don't know, Arkansas, I think, or somewhere.
Texarkana.
Or Texarkana. Texarkana. Yeah, okay. That's close. But he was
right on the border.
Yeah. And there was allegations that the warden had been bribed.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
And to try to, you know, improve conditions and maybe get Tuffy transferred to, or not Tuffy,
right,
but,
right. They want him transferred to Leavenworth, where he'd be real close to home.
Right.
I remember that.
So anyway, long story short, sometime after that, I had a phone call. I think it came to the switchboard, and somebody referred it to me because it had to do with somebody talking about organized crime in Kansas City. And it was a witness in that case. So I ended up flying up to Minnesota to meet him. and we sat up all night in a Holiday Inn bar, or as long as we could anyway. I was drinking coffee and cognac.
Oh, boy.
And this guy told me his whole story. And it was, he was one of those guys I would liken to the one you just mentioned, a hanger-on.
Yeah.
You know, not a big player, not a player at all, really. But he would do things, he observed things, and I think that was how he got. Well, as soon as I wrote my story, they popped him out of the witness protection program.
No, really?
Yeah. I did some more stories on him, I think. And then I get a phone call later. It's him. And he's on the streets.
Yeah.
And so I helped get him into the rehab in downtown Kansas City over there off Cherry, 13th and Cherry or whatever that was.
Yeah, KCCC.
Yeah, KCCC. Yeah. And
I thought you were going to say the city mission in 11th.
No. Uh-uh.
I'm sorry you're on the streets. Here's a dollar for the mission.
No, this is a real deal. Treatment center for
alcohol. This is a real deal.
What do you mean they popped him out of the witness protection because he was in?
He talked to me.
He was in.
Yeah.
And then he decided he had a story to tell.
Right. And I think he felt like he wasn't being treated well.
Yeah.
And but they'd moved him to Minnesota and his family, and they were all up there. Man, I have no idea. I think it was just one of those phone calls that came to the switchboard, because that used to be a way that And
yeah, call in and ask to talk to the desk or to the newsroom,
and they would refer
hook you up to some reporter or an editor or something.
Referred him to me, and I talked to him for a while, and then turned out I did some checks, and he was the real deal.
Yeah, interesting.
And, so yeah,
all right,
interesting story.
Great. All right, Bill. Thanks a lot.
Well, thank you.
I usually do a little public service announcement. If you have a friend or a relative who has a loved one who has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, this has been a great episode. Thank you so much to Bill Norton for stopping by. And if you enjoyed this episode, subscribe, share, and support Gangland Wire. Also, you want to go out and get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available for purchase or rent on Amazon. And when you're watching that, you're going to get on your phone and you're going to download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. If you're in town or around town, you can learn great mob history and take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. And then after that, you're going to go to bed satisfied with the knowledge that you've got a great book to read, Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
And then get the Kindle version for like another $2.
I think it's 99 cents.
99 cents. That's crazy, because for 99 cents, you can hear these mob figures talking about the skim. Distilled down into a great story that is the book Leaving Vegas and the actual audio tapes they used to convict the men. From the mouth of the men that did it, it's Gangland Wire.
All right. Good night, Bill.
Good night.
Say good night, Aaron.
Good night, Aaron. Bumper music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Follow them on Twitter at Odd-O-Matic Music. What about the Richard Grissom case?
Richard Grissom.
He was the guy who killed the three women and supposedly chopped up their bodies in a wood chipper. And they ended up arresting him down in Texas and brought him back.
No, I didn't cover that. I covered that.
That might have been after that you
been,
left.
Yeah,
I'm
yeah.
Not
but
sure. That might have been one of the later ones.
But I covered the one. There were some massage parlor ladies who were turning up dead, and so it turns out one of the girls. Young women was from my hometown. And so I wanted to try to do a backgrounder on her. And then I ended up meeting the guy who was accused of murdering her. He was an interesting character. He also escaped from the county jail. And Van Buskirken, Gary Van Buskirken, was then a sergeant.
St. John,
McGuire was his name.
McGuire, yeah.
Yeah.
Pat McGuire.
Something like that.
Yeah, he ended up taking a hit for an organized crime. He took a fall for an organized crime hit later on. He killed that Strada, Larry Strada.
Really?
Yeah, he was in that case. He was a real professional criminal.
He was the real doom. But I sat down and interviewed him for a couple of hours, that was...
Did you feel like he killed her?
Felt I was that he was totally capable of killing her, and he
killed
was,
more than one. He killed several.
Yeah, he killed several. He was so smooth.
Yeah, too smooth.
That might be another episode for us here if it's a local.
Yeah, I'll have to research that.
Yeah, it was a. It,
I
he
don't
was,
remember much about it right offhand, other than in general.
Yeah, so I still have my hand in.
Yeah.
For a lot of things. Then when DePue came back on the scene, and he was up in Iowa. He was manufacturing
survival
pellets
equipment,
and things like that. And Joe Stevens and I tracked him down up there when he got arrested for child
molestation.
It was taking photos of children in, a hotel room, allegedly for a modeling agency or something like that.
And Robert DePue formed a group called the Minutemen, which was an early right-wing survivalist group.
Right.
Little story. This guy's already been exposed. One of the more important informants for us and the FBI in many ways. Not a real deep throat guy, but a guy who could be around the edges of these guys comfortably.
Yeah.
They turned him out of the Robert DePue thing. He was a kind of crazy guy. And
really?
He got involved with this right wing deal, group. Mm-hmm. And he was going to go around, take a bus and go around the country and pick spots that they may want to go set bombs off whenever they want to start the revolution and, and take over. And the ATF turned him out of that deal and let him go. And he became basically a professional informant the rest of his life.
Really?
He was something else. Now, he couldn't give you the deep throat stuff, the real, smoking gun kind of thing. But he could say, Willie Camisano hangs out at this particular body shop and junkyard.
Okay.
You can find him there most every morning of the week. He could tell you that kind of stuff.
Right.
And so it was pretty important to have a guy who was always out there and could tell you that kind of thing. And he was an interesting guy. He was nuttier than...
Maybe he knew that because he was dropping off stolen cars.
I don't know. We never asked too many questions about what he had got his money. We gave him a little money every now and then.
Yeah. I mean, information was more important.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these guys, they're working both sides.
He never got caught that we know that we did anything that we knew about. So sometimes you turn the blind eye to things like I could tell you stories, which I won't.
Well, how does that work for you as a reporter? I mean,